Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. It's hard not to be disheartened by the news every day coming from the Trump-occupied White House. But one way to stay energized is to resist at the local level. As the Trump administration's federal policies look to favor the fossil fuel industry, state and local authority, especially the power of regulating land use, will likely play an increasingly important part in protecting regions like the Northwest from the risks of coal, oil, and gas. Indeed, threatened by a tsunami of energy export projects, a number of cities and counties in the Northwest are defending themselves from new energy export projects by reforming their land use and development codes. This morning, we talked with Sightline Institute's policy director, Eric DePlace, about how local resistance to the Trump agenda is not just a West Coast phenomenon. We look at how local governments across the United States are experimenting with a variety of opposition strategies to protect themselves from volatile oil trains, widespread fracking, and offshore oil drilling. So listen and take heart. Eric, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having me back.
Well, last October, I was having dinner with a bunch of friends, and one of them asked the question that was unthinkable at the time, what are you going to do if Trump is elected president? And we went around the table describing what we're going to do, and my response was immediately, we're going to work on a local level. And as I said that, I thought, am I for real? You know, is this really going to make a difference, or am I just a pipe dream? So this week, you wrote an article on the Sightline website called Fighting Fossil Fuels at the Local Level. So it seems that we're all kind of thinking on the same wavelength, that maybe the local struggle is the one that matters. So how is that going to materialize, do you think?
Well, I think it's fair to say that I too, in October, thought that the Trump administration was an unthinkable sort of possible dystopian future, which now has become all too thinkable. And, you know, what we've tried to do in the last, you know, really just 2 months, actually, or 2.5 months since he's been elected, is to begin to think really hard about what are the ways that we can persist with the great work that we're doing in the Northwest, defining a clean energy future, and not be caught up in sort of the dragnet and of the federal government and the sort of horrific environmental and other policies that they're intent on enacting. So what that has gotten me to do, and some other folks at Sightline, is to start taking a really hard look at what are the levers of power that we have at the state and local level, and which of those are relatively immune to attacks from the federal government. And you know, as it turns out, I think actually Portland is one of the best case studies of this happening right now. But there are lots of places across the Northwest and across the country that are starting to figure out ways to use the power of local land use law to protect themselves from the ravages of the fossil fuel industry.
Well, it was interesting because you and I had a conversation a few days ago, and that day I just seen an article that's going to be coming out in the current. Actually, I'm not sure which issue of The Nation. I haven't received it yet, but it's a new issue of The Nation magazine. And it's called West Coast Politicians Are Fighting Back Against Donald Trump. And in this article, it focuses pretty much on the local actions of the West Coast. One interesting statistic I saw in that is that I guess right after Trump was inaugurated, 30% of Californians were signed on to seceding from the union. And this article basically talks about how that the Trump administration has stirred up the largest state-level challenges to the federal government since the Civil War. And this article is much broader than just looking at fossil fuel issues, but it's kind of looking at what kind of levers of power states have. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are, particularly being up there in Seattle, where your judge has started off possibly one of the greatest constitutional crises in the 20th century.
Yeah, you know, it's. I would recommend to listeners that article you mentioned in The Nation, which you shared with me, and I thought it was a fantastic and super interesting look at the way that the jurisdictions are taking a different tack. And you know, I work mostly on environment and energy policy and climate policy. But I think it's also fair to say that that's not in some ways the central issue right now that we're looking at with the Trump administration. As listeners may or may not know, the Attorney General of Washington sued the Trump administration over the travel ban, and the Western Washington District Court judge for the federal government basically put a stay on that. And that went to the Ninth Circuit Appellate Court. And the appellate court upheld that stay, and now, of course, the Trump administration is trying to figure out what they're going to do, whether they're going to take it all the way to the Supreme Court or not. But it is pretty clear from the entire body of Washington state politics, the governor, the attorney general, all the senior officials are like, have said plainly that they intend to oppose the administration wholeheartedly on this issue and many other issues too. So they're not making any bones about the fact that they have no interest in playing ball with the new federal government. And that really does set up this interesting potential conflict where, you know, states like Oregon and Washington and California are not going to go backward. They're going to continue to chart the course that they've been charting. Who knows how that's going to sort out, you know, in the coming months or years. But I suspect it's going to be all interesting, uncharted waters.
Well, the other day I heard an interview with Ellen Rosenblum, who's the Oregon Attorney General, and was on Oregon Public Broadcasting. And she was sounding pretty feisty and fiery and kind of out there in the same limb, let's say, as the attorney generals of Washington and California. I'm happy to hear it. And it sounds like there's a lot of bonding going on around state attorney generals in Democratic states. Now, there's the other issue, and the your article looks at what's going on around the country. Like in Colorado and Boulder County, there's been some struggles to try to outlaw banning, to try to ban fracking there. And there's a problem because the state legislature passed a law that basically, or maybe it was a ballot measure, I don't remember, that basically forbids local communities from banning fracking. So how does this landscape play out in places that are a little bit less amenable to the kinds of changes we've seen over the last 10 or 15 years, places that are less amenable than, let's say, Washington, Oregon, and California?
Yeah, and this is exactly the question that we face with local land use and with local control in general. So what happened in Boulder is that the community there had enacted a ban on fracking in that county, and that had been, it was a moratorium that had been upheld or sort of extended several times. But then the oil and gas industry was successful in passing a ballot measure that preempted, that's the term of art in legal circles, preempted localities from regulating fracking and drilling, and put that at the state level. And the reason that they did that is because the industry believed that if it were preempted to the state level, they would have much more control, they'd get much more favorable outcomes for the fossil fuel industry. And so what we see this with railroads all the time, where states and localities cannot regulate railroads, or they can do very, very few things to modify railroad behavior. All of that authority is preempted by the federal government. And of course, the railroads have a near lock on the regulatory agencies that are supposed to oversee them. So this dynamic that we've seen playing out in Colorado and Boulder is, I think, the dynamic that we're going to be wrestling with in the coming months and years, which is there are a lot of jurisdictions, particularly in the East and in California, that have banned fracking. And so then we get into this wrestling match. Well, will the states try to preempt those localities? Will the federal government try to preempt states? I mean, New York State, for example, has banned fracking across the entire state. Will the oil and gas industry try to make some move through Congress where they will prevent states from having that authority? And if they do try something like that, does that not set up a really big, potentially constitutional question about the ability of states to regulate what happens within their borders or not? And so, you know, there is at the moment lots of reason to believe that localities and states have a ton of power that they need to protect themselves. But, you know, it's not crazy to think that in the future, this could be the sort of thing that we're going to have, you know, pretty robust arguments over.
We're talking this morning with Eric DePlace, who is the policy director for Sightline Institute in Seattle. And we're talking about ways that we can work on a local level to, first of all, stave off the worst offenses of the Trump administration on the way of life we've come to value here in the Northwest in particular. And more than that, to continue to move forward with our agenda. Just before we took a break, Eric, we were talking about or alluding to the things that have been happening in Oregon that are really positive in terms of showing the strength of working at a local level. So I want to talk a little bit about that and even look at some of the challenges there. I'm figuring you're probably thinking mostly about the city council's resolution that's now an ordinance to ban fossil fuel infrastructure in the city of Portland.
That's right. So, I think about a lot about energy infrastructure and about fossil fuel infrastructure. So I think about oil pipelines, gas pipelines, coal terminals, and so forth. And what we had seen in the Northwest and some other places was localities kind of nibbling at these questions. And, you know, so the cities of Hoquiam and Aberdeen, for example, out on the Washington coast, they had passed ordinances that prevented the construction of new crude oil storage tanks. And the reason they did that was to lock out future proposals for oil trains in those communities. It passed overwhelmingly in a fairly conservative environment. We'd seen things like that, and they were very positive. And then all of a sudden, and although, there's, of course, a history behind this, Portland really leaped out to the front of the pack and passed what we believe is by far the most comprehensive and assertive defense in by basically changing the way that zoning and land use is going to work in Portland so that new fossil fuel infrastructure for export will be essentially impossible. And so Portland really moved out and set down a new standard for thinking about how this can work and how a locality can all by itself, without permission by the, from the state, without permission from the federal government, can set forth a really clear vision for where that place is going to go in the future. The story, of course, starts with a proposal for a propane by rail facility and a small pipeline. But the story that Portland is now telling for the rest of the country is extremely positive. And my strong suspicion is that we will see other places try to replicate that, at least in some fashion. Whatcom County, up in northwest Washington, that's where Bellingham is pursuing sort of a smaller version of that right now, that I think is also potentially very positive.
Now, one concern that I have about the Portland ordinance is it's now being appealed to the State Land Use Board of Appeals mm-hmm. by a couple of different fossil fuel companies. I don't know that it has much, that the appeal has much chance of sinking the Portland ordinance, but it does show that the fossil fuel industry is not giving up. And there's concern also that with the Trump administration, a lot of fossil fuel companies are feeling emboldened to stick to it.
Right. I mean, and there's, if you were a fossil fuel company, you probably feel emboldened too. I mean, the Trump administration has given every signal that they intend to do what they can to step on the accelerator of the bad old way of doing business. You're right. So Western States Petroleum and a couple of other trade groups are appealing Portland's ordinance to the State Land Use Board. We'll have to see how it plays out. I mean, we expect that most of these attempts to lock out fossil fuels will face legal challenges of some kind. It also looks like it's a pretty clear-cut case where, localities are allowed to regulate for health and safety. They are allowed to protect the health of their citizens. And much of this stuff clearly is hazardous. And so we're gonna see how the courts weigh in on this. But, I'll be honest with you, I'm pretty optimistic that this stuff is not in the gray area, that it's solidly within the power that states and localities have reserved for them. Now, the question, as I said earlier, is will the federal government try to step in and in some way preempt places from basically taking control of their own future? That's going to be, I imagine that's coming down the pike at some point, and I think that's going to be where the wrestling match gets quite interesting.
Yeah, well, I also see that we're seeing that with the Trump's administration struggle with the judiciary just over the travel ban. That I think we're seeing an administration that does not respect the rule of law and is also going to try to meddle with judges. So it is going to be very interesting to see. And I'm just thinking about what do we do to support our judiciary in its present form besides doing satires and Saturday Night Live of Trump going to the People's Court.
Right. Well, the satires are satisfying on some level, but you're right. It's not going to save us in the end. And these are such bigger questions that ultimately, of course, our judges are appointed by elected officials. And so, unless we have all of the components that support more positive outcomes, we're facing some real, profound long-term difficulties. So. I don't have a crisp answer for that, but we are going to need to wrest control of Congress back from the Trump administration, or from the Republicans, I'll say. And I don't mean that in a partisan sense, but I do mean that in the sense that the judiciary is probably under a pretty sustained attack from the Trump administration. I mean, they've said that clearly. And the Republican-dominated Congress does not seem inclined to put a check on them, which is quite concerning.
Well, I wanted to look at two examples you have in your article of one a victory, one not so much a victory, where the judiciary was involved. And one was an effort in Benicia, California, to stop oil trains, I believe.
Yes, that's right.
And then the other one was actually a small town outside of my hometown in Massachusetts, Grafton, Massachusetts, where they tried to do a similar effort and it was overturned by the judiciary. So let's first talk about Benicia and then talk about Grafton and why was there a difference between the two?
Yeah, so this is a very, we thought this was sort of an illustrative case study for how cities and states can go about regulating to protect themselves and what they can do and what they can't do. So what happened in Benicia is Valero, which is a big oil company that's very present in California, not so present in the Northwest, they had proposed to basically build an oil train unloading facility there. And the city said, no, we don't want to do that. We don't want to allow them to do that. And so what they said to Valero was, no, we're not going to allow you to build this facility. Valero then appealed that to a federal agency called the Surface Transportation Board. And the Surface Transportation Board is the agency that regulates railroads. And they said, well, Benicia is effectively trying to regulate railroads because they're preventing the construction of this facility that would take rail cargo. And the STB weighed in, and they said, no, that's not right. They're not regulating a railroad. Valero, you're not a railroad. You're an oil company. And the city does, in fact, have authority, or at least we're not going to impinge on their authority, to decide what can and cannot be built within city limits. Now, the case in Grafton, Massachusetts, was quite similar. And in that case, there was a company that was trying to build basically a propane facility that was not too dissimilar to what was in Portland, but it was going to be brought in on rail, the propane was. And Grafton tried to stop that from happening. And in that case, the STB had weighed in and said that it actually did impinge on the federal government's sole authority to regulate railroads. The difference between those ends up being relatively subtle, but it hinges on the fact on the notion about sort of where you're regulating. So a locality can regulate an oil company that's building a piece of infrastructure. They cannot regulate a railroad directly. And in the case of Grafton, the STB had weighed in and said, well, it's not really any business of yours what cargo they're handling. You don't have the authority to regulate the railroad. And so the subtle distinction between those two is that we have to make sure that when we are taking steps to preserve authority, that we're not trying to regulate the railroads, which unfortunately we can't do, but that we do have some control over the construction of new infrastructure. And it's on that sort of distinction where I think Portland is going to be completely fine with the new land use ordinances that are in place, because they're clearly regulating the construction of new infrastructure on parcels that the city has zoning control over, not trying to regulate cargo on railroad.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Eric DePlace with Sightline Institute, and we're talking about how we can fight Trump's energy policies and probably a lot of his other policies on the local level. Eric, I was talking with a friend the other day, and she was describing her impressions of Trump draining the swamp, and in the process of draining the swamp, he has exposed all the monsters.
That's right. You do kind of get the image of the creature from Black Lagoon has been lurking in the bottom this whole time, and now it's all of a sudden there.
Well, that's kind of an aside. And I guess one of the things to finish up about Benicia and Grafton, I was thinking as I was reading your article and thinking, Grafton, Massachusetts, this is a place I remember quite well. And it's a place that, like Hoquiam and Longview and a lot of places in Washington, has had no economy since the 1920s, probably. And I found it interesting that they were trying to stop a fossil fuel development because one of the arguments always is jobs, jobs, jobs. And this is a community that really needs the jobs. So what do you think it means that places like Grafton, Massachusetts, along with Hoquiam and Kalama and Longview are not happy about having these fossil fuel facilities being built in their communities?
Yeah, you know, I think that is one of the most interesting dynamics right now. It used to be that, you know, companies, big fossil fuel companies would come in, promise jobs, and, you know, of course, the promises never really lived up to reality, or reality never lived up to the promises, I should say. And I think more and more what is happening in those places, Kalama and Longview are good examples. Actually, Tacoma is a good example where there was a huge methanol refinery recently.
Huge methanol refinery that was being proposed.
That was proposed. That's right. That was proposed. And I think what is happening, what I've observed, is that the people who live there realize that they're being picked on. They realize that they're being targeted by these companies. Those companies, you're not seeing proposals to build a huge coal terminal in downtown Seattle or in in downtown Portland, you're not seeing petrochemical refineries proposed, you know, for wealthy suburbs that host the technology industry. You're seeing them target the places that are least able to protect themselves and that are the most vulnerable. And I think what's happening in those communities is people realize now that, you know, that there is there are very real economic challenges in front of them. And the petrochemical and fossil fuel industry does not offer anything like a solution. What it offers is a recipe for, you know, essentially long-term economic losses, failure, and it will prevent new positive investment from going into those communities. And so there's this real sense of anger, and I think it's a well-justified and righteous anger that bubbles up in a lot of these places, saying, look, we know that our economy is struggling. We know that we need a different future. And if, you know, we end up with huge oil train facilities here, you can bet your bottom dollar that we're not going to get a new and better future. I don't know Grafton, Massachusetts, but it sounds like kind of a similar dynamic is at work there. That, you know, the only people who don't acknowledge that the oil and coal industry is a bad industry that people don't want, that's the Trump administration and a few last holdouts. For the most part, people really get that.
Well, you know, as an interesting aside, a few weeks ago, actually it was during the beginning of all the controversy about the Rex Tillerson nomination for Secretary of State, and I was reviewing an interview that I did with your colleague Nick Abraham just about a year ago, and we're talking about community concerns about not wanting to have all kinds of different fossil fuel developments in their community and how it gets forced mostly on low-income communities and communities of color. And he says, well, Rex Tillerson, who is the CEO of Exxon, and his neighbors fought a fracking development that was outside their gated community, and I don't know if it was in Houston or Dallas. And I'm listening to this, and I had no idea who Rex Tillerson was a year ago when I was talking with Nick. And suddenly I'm thinking, this is really ironic. This guy, Mr. Exxon, fossil fuel king of the world, go to the country and take their oil, and Trump's pick for Secretary of State fought a fracking development in his own neighborhood.
Yeah, Nick has Nick disliked Rex Tillerson long before it was cool, and with good reason. I mean, I wish his nomination had gotten more attention. It was sort of the limelight was taken by other horrible nominees, but he has really been a remarkable cynic about these issues for years and years, and it's actually disgusting that somebody like him is now in charge of the State Department. You know, not only does he have very troublesome dealings in Russia and other places, but he's been just absolutely mind-bogglingly hypocritical about issues like oil and gas development. The one that you mentioned is a great example of that. You know, it's sometimes said that he supported a carbon tax when he was at Exxon, which is a reading of history that you can sort of justify only by squinting really, really hard at what happened. And, you know, what he actually did was float a proposal in order to kill off a very viable cap-and-trade proposal that Exxon didn't like that was coming in the early years of the Obama administration. And since then, he's done less than nothing to support any kind of carbon pricing or carbon reduction scheme. And in fact, Exxon, under his leadership, spent untold millions of dollars denying climate science. So I'm going to wander off track and start ranting too much about Mr. Tillerson, but it's really just a grotesque choice for that position.
Well, since I promised people at the beginning of the show that we're going to give people something to take heart, what can listeners look forward to in terms of ways in which we can work on a local level to really hold off the worst and to start working for the best?
Yeah, that's a great way to take the conversation. Thank you. You know, I think at the way to engage now is to double down and triple down and quadruple down on engagement in democracy and in local government. We have all of the power that we need to chart a clean energy future in the Northwest and on the West Coast. And what that means is showing up at those city council meetings and those port commission hearings, every other hearing that matters, land use boards and so forth, and getting our elected officials to do what we all want them to do anyway, which is to create communities that are safe and vibrant and have a long-term future for us. That means preventing, just as Portland has done, preventing the construction of new petrochemical and fossil fuel facilities for export. Those aren't in our best interest. They're not in anybody's best interest. And so, you know, if you're in Portland, you can check that box already. and you know, perhaps start thinking about other ways to make the city even better. But if you're in Vancouver, Washington, if you're in any of the other places that are being targeted by these projects, the path forward, I think, is clear. It's achievable, and it's something that we can do in the immediate future.
I actually have been thinking, and one of my thoughts right after the election was, I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing, because I listen to you and you talk about holding the thin green line. And so if we can hold the thin green line, we really can undermine the fossil fuel industry.
Yes, well, and I'll say this too, and this is maybe a segue to plug in KABU. I mean, what you're doing, Barbara, at KABU matters a lot for helping people get informed about these issues, helping them engage in really positive forms of civic democracy. And I hope that all the listeners who are tuned in right now really get the value proposition there. So there is a lot that we can accomplish in the Northwest. The thin green line, this notion that this place is able to stand up to the fossil fuel industry and prevent huge quantities of carbon from being released. That's all real. It's based in an analysis of the energy industry that stands up to scrutiny. We have a tremendous opportunity in front of us right now if we can maintain that line of defense.
Well, Eric, thanks very much for joining us today, and we'll talk again real soon.
Good. Thank you, Barbara.
Okay. We've been talking this morning with Eric DePlace, who's Policy Director for Sightline Institute in Seattle, and you've been listening to Locust Focus here on KABU Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locust-focus. Next week, we'll talk with Tyson Slocum, who's with Public Citizen, about Donald Trump's pick to head the EPA and the man behind it, Carl Icahn. My engineer is Derek Crooks. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music, especially for the pledge drive by Laura Nero. Thanks for listening.